Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The Zong is a notorious name in a terrible chapter of British colonial history. That ship was at the centre of an infamous court case in 1783, after 133 slaves were thrown overboard as part of an insurance scam.
What happened on the Zong happened thousands upon thousands of times, because generally when the ships approached their destination, they threw the slaves that were sick, they threw them overboard, and they obviously threw overboard the dead ones because they wanted to get a good price on the slave market when they sold flesh, as it was called.
This awful trade in human flesh brought guilt and shame on a nation more than two centuries ago. By contrast, it was uplifting to hear on deck men and women, black and white together, singing hymns and songs of freedom, rejoicing that many were indeed free at last.
And can it be? I've always, there's something about the hymn that spoke to me, the words themselves. And particularly it says, my chains fell off, my heart was free, I rose, went up and followed thee. And it's just that release, and it quite fits in with the theme, free at last. As a Christian, free from sin, free from everything, but just that great period of freedom, being set free.
I think it's terribly important that we do understand what happened 200 years ago and before that, and our involvement in the slave trade. I think it's a bit like the Holocaust. I think everybody needs to know why we're such a wealthy country today. So much is built on the past and the work of the slaves, and I've become much more aware of what really happened in those days than I was before, and it's been great to be involved in this day and in some of the other events that are taking place this week.
Then the moment arrived when HMS Northumberland came alongside, complete with helicopter hovering above the waters. The might of the Royal Navy had come to bring us safely into port. As we moved upriver with our escort, the sheer scale of this occasion was apparent. The presence of Her Majesty's warship reminded us that the Navy also played a significant part in enforcing the abolition of the gruesome trade in human cargo 200 years ago.
Decals, Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of racism. Today's date, Monday, February 22nd, 2016. So I have been told, for folks who have been following our book study session on Edward Baptist, his 2014 publication, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Lots of great details in the book, very well referenced. I've been saying the whole time that we've been reading it, it probably would be a good idea to check the footnotes. You'll probably see several different publications that you'd like to check out. They have lots of autobiographical accounts of black people that were enslaved, black people who escaped, not just some of the more popular ones from Harriet Jacobs, Frederick Douglass, Charles Ball, people that you probably have heard, 12 Years a Slave, certainly, not some of the more popular items, also has some more obscure references, references people probably are not familiar with. For myself, one of those was The Zong. I had not heard of it, didn't know anything about it, checked it out, and had some great time reading the book that we are going to discuss today. One of the things I can say, I try to emphasize this consistently, racism should not just be isolated to something that is an American problem. With everything that's been discussed here over the last couple years or so, this is a global problem, should be studied and understood as such. So we always are really excited when we can have guests on the program from different parts of the world. With that, our guest for today's program, it's going to be a treat to discuss his book on The Zong, this kind of infamous massacre that took place right at the end of the 18th century. In addition to this book, he has authored, edited approximately 30 different books, many of them dealing with slavery, racism. We're just talking about one today. Some of his other titles include Black Presence, A Documentary History of the Negro in England. He also worked on Black and White, The Negro and English Society. He is a professor of history emeritus at the University of York. Joining us live from the United Kingdom, Mr. James Walvin. Mr. Walvin, are you with us, sir?
I'm with you. Yes, indeed, Gus.
Outstanding. Glad to have you on the program this evening for you. For any of our listeners who this might be their first time hearing from you, anything that you think would be important for listeners to know about you before we get started?
Yes, I'm a historian, and I've been working on slavery and slave-related topics throughout my career, really. I started in 1967, so that's a long time ago.
Wow.
And in that time, I published quite a lot, but also the subject itself has changed. What in 1967 seemed a kind of distant subject to large numbers of people on both sides of the Atlantic, now it's full square, right in the middle of how we think about America was made, how we think about how modern Europe came into being. This is a subject that's changed in a lifetime, from something that people regarded as marginal to something that is absolutely central to where we are now.
I certainly agree, and that is the main thesis of the book. That's how I found out about your work that we're going to discuss today. The half has never been told. That is the main argument that Mr. Baptist is making, and I think it's painfully obvious. Before we get to The Zong, you are a white man, is that correct?
I'm a white man.
Okay.
I'm a white man.
This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. Mm-hmm. I use them as synonyms, and I have the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Mm-hmm. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
It's accurate in a way. It goes broad in that, doesn't it? I mean, there are all kinds of racisms. I mean, a lot of people in India that don't like people of darker color. There's some strange attitudes towards race in India, some strange attitudes towards race in Asia. But, I mean, the kind of thing that we're talking about here is the extraordinary phenomenon of how a white world came to think of black people as being deeply inferior to themselves and not even in the same kind of categories themselves. One of the great difficulties of the last century and more has been actually reversing that. And am I not a man and a brother? Am I not a woman and a sister? Asserting that general equality has been one of the great difficulties in political and social life throughout the English-speaking world. Hmm. And it's been trying to overthrow that attitude, which was shaped and forged in the years of Atlantic slavery.
Okay. I just want to go back to the definition. The reason mm-hmm. for it being broad is that I have concluded, yes, you might have different groups of non-white people who dislike and or mistreat other non-white people. That certainly is correct. That happens here in the States as well. However, what mm-hmm. I have concluded is that the dominant power on this planet in the form of people, the people who classify themselves as white, dominate and are more powerful than all the individuals who classify themselves as non-white, and that operates worldwide. Yeah. Is that accurate?
That's true enough.
Right on. Before we get to your book specifically, there's a quote that I've been trying to ask as many white people that come on the program as possible just to see if they think it's accurate mm-hmm. because the quote is talking about white people. Now, this was written by a non-white person, but that notwithstanding, the quote, and he was talking about racism. He says, "White people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely mm-hmm. are they pained enough." And I'm just focusing on the first portion of that sentence where he says, "White people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism." You're a white man, the white people that you're mm-hmm. around, family, friends, is that accurate? The white people, do you see a sizable... You said, of course it is?
Yeah, amongst our people are pained by it, yes, when they look at...
Sincerely and greatly pained. Sincerely and greatly pained.
There is, some are, some aren't, but most of the people I would mix with, and my friends would certainly fit that category, yeah.
And how do they demonstrate this sincere and great pain about racism?
Well, an abhorrence whenever they meet it. I mean, take the current presidential primaries. I mean, it's hard to look at that without seeing racism popping up all over the place and feeling this is not worthy of the United States. The United States is devoted to a different kind of ideology than that in principle, and this is a kind of racism rearing its head in a way that friends of America feel very, very alarmed about.
Okay. I have, and since you're talking about something that's happening here in the States, I feel like I'm pretty familiar with that. I certainly do not see sincere and great pain about racism in the current presidential election. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump just won his second primary in a row this weekend down in South Carolina. That, to me, does not seem like a whole lot of white people were sincerely and greatly pained. But
no, it doesn't. No, I agree. I'm just saying that there are incidents in the U.S. that people who feel that way do feel very pained about. There are elements of deep-rooted racism that seem to be ineradicable, and what will we do about that? I'm an outsider. You know, I spend a lot of time every year in the USA, and I'm a friend of America, but there are things about it that make you feel pretty unhappy.
We will get to your book. Fascinating text, fascinating incident. Kind of get to some of the major themes and then get to the actual event that took place on the Zong. Why did you construct this topic? When I was reading the book, you kind of talked about, I mentioned some of the other texts that you've written that also deal with slavery, mm-hmm. racism.
Right.
And you said that this incident on this slave ship, the Zong, kind of kept popping up in your work. You felt it was deserving of a full treatise in a book. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I came across it really in the 60s when I was writing about other aspects of slavery, and we didn't know much about it at the time, partly because, you know, people had not done the research. Like, we knew about it as an incident, but there'd be no detailed research into the materials. And I mentioned it in passing, but it was just yet another incident of grotesque violence done to Africans on the slave ships and by slave owners in the Atlantic. And I kept circling around it, writing about it for a paragraph here, a paragraph there. And eventually, I mean, of course, one of the difficulties with historians is you're dealing with a subject that is extraordinarily painful for a lot of people. This is not as if you're writing about the rise of the cotton industry in the north of England. You're talking about something that people have a tremendous emotional charge about. It's about the people that they knew and came from. And I was very hesitant about writing about something that had that kind of emotional charge. You know, because it's not something that you can enter lightly. But on the other hand, it's also a really important topic. And I thought that some of the other people that had written about it didn't talk about it, didn't write about it in a way that I felt was satisfactory. There was one book in particular that was, I thought, particularly badly written, and that I thought was did no favors whatsoever to the victims that we're looking at on the Zong. And I thought, I can actually do better than that. I could tell a different story and be do greater justice to the subject and to the people who died on that ship. And after a while, I felt like the time was right to write something in detail about it. That was, as I say, about 40 years after I'd first mentioned it. And eventually, I homed in on it, and I thought, right, let's go for it. And I did The Zong.
Mm. Full title for listeners, The Zong, A Massacre, The Law and the End of Slavery. As I was reading your book, and it was fascinating for many reasons, we did an audio segment where they were talking about J. Marion Sims. This is a white man from the 19th century. He's known as the father of gynecology. He did all these innovations, medical innovations for surgery and what have you. Unfortunately, this came at the expense of black females. He tortured them, did all these surgeries on them without anesthesia. This went on for more than a decade. And this kind of gets kind of the same thing that you just mentioned. This kind of gets short shrift. People don't really mention this. They don't really talk about the victims, people that he tortured in all of this. And a black professor, she was asked, because J. Marion Sims, he has a lot of statues here in the United States. And she was asked what should be done with those statues. And she said that her mind changed. She went to Liverpool and she saw statues to African slaves. And apparently it was a black person who was conducting the tour. And the same question popped up on this tour: what should be done with these statues? And I thought, wow, this is so fascinating to hear this at the time that we're reading your book. Just recognizing the importance of the city Liverpool to the slave trade. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I mean, you can't really talk about Liverpool without thinking of the slave trade. I mean, the city came to prominence. It rose to be a great port on the back of ships being sent to Africa to buy Africans for the Americas. We know, for instance, about 1750 to 1800, one African in five crosses the Atlantic in a ship out of Liverpool. Now, you know, that tells you something about Liverpool. You wander around the streets of Liverpool, look at the street names, look at the buildings, look at the town hall. The town hall has faces carved into the side of it of Africans. Now, why would a building in the north of England have African faces on the side of it? Well, the reason is that Liverpool's wealth and prominence emerged from selling those Africans from West Africa into the Caribbean mainly and to North America, and returning with the produce that the slaves had cultivated. So Liverpool is at the heart, really, of England's rise as a great major slave power in the late 17th and 18th century. You cannot think about the history of Liverpool without thinking of slavery. And indeed, there's a terrific museum there. The Slavery Museum is one of the best museums devoted to slavery anywhere. But you look at the buildings. The buildings speak to slavery. The street names. Take, for instance, that Beatles song, Penny Lane. Remember Penny Lane? That was named after a man called William Penny, who was one of Liverpool's great slave traders. But who thinks of that? Who thinks of Penny Lane as having anything to do with the slave trade? But it does. It takes you right back to the 18th century, right back to the men who made their millions on the sweat of Africans and shipping them into the Americas.
Wow. Have there been any calls to remove some of these statues?
I suppose there have. Rather like the big argument going on at Oxford recently about removing the statue of Cecil Rhodes. But the problem then is you're into all kinds of problems, aren't you, about rewriting history. These people, we need to remember all this. We don't want to pretend this didn't happen. We don't want to pretend these people didn't exist. These were the people that created the issues that we're talking about. I don't think you can go around rewriting history. This becomes a kind of real serious problem. But there's a way of dealing with it. And what we need to do, first of all, is remember our history properly. What we need to remember is that Penny was a slave trader. What we need to remember is that Liverpool was a slave trading port. What we need to remember is that Liverpool, the people living there, rose to prosperity on the back of Africans.
Wow. Great segue. One of the paragraphs early on in your text, this is where you're just kind of explaining this whole process and how Liverpool came to be such a beacon of the slave trade peddling black flesh. This is from chapter 2, The City Built on Slavery. This paragraph you write, "The particular process of slave trading on the African coast depended on local geography, but it thrived best when there were good proven relations, trust between slave captains and local Africans. Here, Liverpool merchants excelled, developing steady personal and commercial links with African elites. Indeed, relations were so firm, so mutually beneficial, notably at the ports of Bani and Old Calabar, that African traders were granted unsecured credit for supplying their slaves, just as planters in the colonies were allowed credit for the purchase of the slaves. The trading conducted by Liverpool's merchants was mutually beneficial." And the thing that stuck out in that passage, actually, you say it twice, mutually beneficial. And I thought, is that true? Like, did you have African cities, African people that prospered in the same way that whites in Liverpool and Europe prospered? Is that an accurate statement?
Sure. I mean, Pete, you and we could argue about this, but how do the Europeans get their Africans? They don't grab them. I mean, those Africans are, it's a trade. They buy them. They exchange them for goods. They know the particular people that they're going to go to trade with. When a ship leaves Liverpool, the captain has letters of introduction to particular African traders on the coast saying, this is the man who wants French brandy. This is the man that wants textiles from India. This is the man who wants cowrie shells from the Maldive Islands. They know where to go. They know who to go to. And if it doesn't work out, and if the African trader doesn't like what's offered, he just won't deal with the Europeans. It's an extraordinary business, actually. And the Africans who actually benefit from this, the traders, I mean, the Africans that are loaded onto the slave ships are not grabbed by the Europeans on the coast. They're grabbed by other Africans in the interior. Some of them come from hundreds of miles away. The Europeans can't go into the interior. Europeans don't go into the African interior until really, apart from a few of the rivers, until mid-late 19th century because of the tropical diseases. They have to rely on internal networks to bring slaves to them. So it's this complex question of how the trade in Africa delivers enslaved people to the European traders on the coast. And the same way, and it is the same on East Africa, and it's the same on the Mediterranean coast. There are huge numbers of Africans sold east and north through trading systems that exist beyond the sight, really, of the Europeans on the coast, or the Arabs on the coast in the case of East Africa.
Right. I got that, that you have to have exchange, that it's Africans that are going and doing this, and there's trading, bartering going on in this process, that white people often are not the ones that are going in directly. But I'm specifically talking about it being mutually beneficial, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. You have in the book where, as a result of this, Liverpool explodes financially. This is not just prosperous for people like the Gregsons. You get all kinds of civic projects out of this. This drastically elevates the economic benefits for the entire city of Liverpool, not just one or two people. Certainly they get their riches and what have you, but this becomes great for the whole city. Is that the case? If it's mutually beneficial, is that the case for the Africans?
It's certainly mutually beneficial to the men who are doing the trading. Whether that spreads down from them to others, it's hard to tell. But there are large numbers of very prosperous African traders who, for instance, don't want the slave trade to end. What are they going to do when business is over after 1807, 1808? They don't like the idea of the slave trade ending because that's their livelihood. Now, how far that spills over into a broader society, we don't really know. But the slave traders themselves do well. Why are they in it? I mean, they're in it like everybody else to make money, profit, material well-being from it. You know, this is not something that's just one-way traffic. A lot of people make money from it.
Got it. Just that right there where you're saying it's hard to tell if it's spilled over, it seems like it's not hard to tell at all. You still have the evidence today that the entire city of Liverpool benefited from this. Europe as a whole benefited.
That's clear enough here.
Exactly. Yeah. And the fact that you don't have clear evidence of that on the continent, to me, that statement is not accurate. This was not mutually beneficial at all, particularly if we take the broad view from this. This was not at all. And for me, when I see statements like that from white authors, I suspect that that could be an act of racism when a white person characterizes...
Right. Okay. Well,
the system is in that sort of way.
Okay, that's your take on it, but I mean, that's not mine.
Okay, right on. Moving forward, You have a lot of information that I did really appreciate. I actually want to read this one quick passage and you can comment, because I hear so frequent. I don't just hear this from white people. I hear this from black people, white people, and I hear it all the time, that black people are the biggest cowards in the world. How are you just going to be enslaved and have somebody shackle you and toss you on a ship? Black people are lame. Black people are cowards. They deserve what they got. They didn't fight back. I hear this all the time, as I said, from white people and black people. And I say this even more vigorously now. Anyone who says that, you should stop talking immediately. Go do research. Just one quick passage from your text. This is, I have the e-version, so my page numbers might not correspond to people who have physical book, but this is chapter 3, Crews and Captives, okay. Where you write...
What page is this then?
Well, for me, it's 88, but again, I have the ebook version, so I don't know, you know,
how
that works.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
But you write, you're talking about different crew members, and they say that one unguarded hour or minute is sufficient to give the slaves the opportunity they are always waiting for. An attempt to rise upon the ship's company brings an instantaneous and horrid war. A careless moment by a crew member, a simple lapse of attention, an incautious move could provoke a violent African response. In 1721, Captain Francis Messervy ignored a warning not to walk among the African men while they ate, without a heavy armed guard. The Africans laid hold on him and beat out his brains with the little tubs out of which they eat the boiled rice. The ensuing revolt was only quelled when 80 Africans had been killed. No crew, counseled John Newton, could relax entirely, even when the Africans were subdued. When most quiet, they were always watching for opportunity. Great passage, in my opinion. Can you comment just on how frequent revolts and uprisings were on these slave ships?
Well, we know that at least one slave ship in 10 had some kind of slave revolt, slave insurrection on board. We're pretty sure it's more than that, but, you know, the ones that we know of, it suggests it's 1 in 10 and possibly more. And, well, why, for instance, why are the Africans chained on a slave ship? Why are they chained? Well, the reason is, if they weren't chained, they'd be at the crew's throat. These are not passive people that are just being... shuffling to their fate in the Americas. These are people who will take whatever opportunity comes their way to free themselves, to take their revenge on their captors, to turn things around, throw the crew overboard. The problem is, once they're at sea, these are people who don't have any kind of training on a sailing ship. What do they do? You know, we know any number of ships that actually are lost completely in slave upheaval. They blow up, they're destroyed in fire, they're destroyed, they explode, they'd simply disappear. We don't know what happened. But the idea that the slave trade is a passive experience, it's not true, and the evidence rings right across the whole history of the slave trade, that the slave crew know that they are facing an extraordinarily volatile group of people. They know that unless they keep the lid on them, and that is keep them in chains, and if they know that if they don't point their firearms at them, and remember, the guns on the slave ship point inward, not outwards. I mean, how many ships have guns pointing inwards? Most of them point outwards, but slave ships have swivel guns that point inward, because the danger to them is from their human cargoes. So anyone that says that these people don't show any kind of resistance to what's happening to them simply don't know what the experience of a slave ship is like.
That is a great point as well. I think that might have been the first time that I came across that slave ships actually having guns that are pointing inward, not outward. Mm. Great point. Yeah. Great point.
But you see, it also raises this question of chains. You know, chains have a very bad image, don't they, now? Black people don't like the idea of Africans in chains, because it conjures up the very thing you started off asking me about: African submission, African quietism, whatever. But actually, you can turn that whole thing the other way around. You can stand it on its head. You can say what the chains do is actually, they actually speak to African resistance. They speak to the fact that without the chains, the Africans would have overthrown the system. They would have overthrown the crew on the slave ships. They would have overthrown the slave ship itself.
Mm.
Why does every single slave ship leave Europe and North America and Brazil with huge numbers of chains below decks? Not just chains, but manacles. They leave because they know that the African cargoes are dangerous. And you cannot trust that. If you're a sailor, if you're a captain, if you're a merchant, you take your life in your hands if you trust them for a second. Hello?
Oops, what? Smacked my mute button by accident. Again, Mr. James Wildman, our guest for the program. You have a fascinating image that's on the cover of your book, and it kind of weaves through your narrative as you're telling the story. You go through the trial and everything. Can you talk about this Turner portrait?
Yes, the Turner painting, which is in the Museum of Fine Art in Boston, which is one of Turner's great paintings, so often thought to be one of his great pictures. Because Turner was fascinated by sea and seascapes. But this is a picture of a slave ship, of people being thrown overboard. And it's horrific, drowning people being devoured by sharks in a storm, on a slave ship in a tempest in the background, all in a kind of extraordinary kind of blood-like background of storm. Now, the interesting thing about that painting is that it was painted many years after the Zong incident. And why did Turner come back to this theme? Why did he come back to something that happened 50, 60 years before? Well, the interesting question there is that what happened on the Zong doesn't end with the Zong. We now know there are many more incidents like that that happened well into the 19th century. And in fact, there are perhaps more of them in the early 19th century, in the 1820s and 1830s, particularly from Brazilian ships in the South Atlantic. And there are more incidents like that because both the U.S. and the Royal Navy have changed their mind about this, and they're trying to prevent the slave ships. The Brazilians are still trying to ferry Africans to Brazil, and they try to outrun the Royal Navy and the American Navy. And when they can't do it, if they look if they're going to be caught up with and have the ship impounded, they throw people overboard. So, and those stories are repeated in the American press, and they're repeated in the British press throughout the 1820s and 1830s. So these horrific stories of large numbers of Africans being killed deliberately offshore Africa, in rivers in Africa, and on the high seas, so that the slave ship and the owner won't have the whole ship confiscated by the Royal Navy and the American Navy, and they pretend not to be a slave ship. So they ditch people. And I think what that picture does is it's a fantastic picture, and if you're in Boston, go and see it. It's small, actually. When I first saw it, I was expecting a big picture because it hits you and looking at the reproductions of it. It's actually quite small, but it overpowers you, really, because what it does is brings forth, really visually, in a way that very few other things do, this terrible, terrible story.
Wow. If we have listeners, I would concur, if we have listeners that are in Boston, you should definitely go check out the painting. A great way to kind of have this, begin this conversation, understanding the horrors of all of this. And if that's not feasible, you can just look at the cover of Mr. Wildman's book. He's got a reproduction of it right there. If you're on our Facebook page, you can see for the post for the program today, you can see a reproduction of the image, and it is definitely worth checking out. One of the themes that pops up, this is recurrent in Edward Baptist's book, really all of the books, in my opinion, that are more accurate in talking about slavery, where they're not giving you a racist image, where they omit and give a lot of euphemisms. Rape is a central aspect of this system. We just talked about that with the American Slave Coast. You write, again, not my pages, you know, might not match up, but this is also in chapter 3. For me, it's on page 92. You write, sometimes captains selected African women for their own gratification on the voyage, removing them from the slave decks to their own quarters. Though captains were generally keen to prevent predatory sexual attacks by crewmen, some allowed their men to have sex with captive women. John Newton himself, no sexual innocent in his early slave trading days, thought that the ship's captain set the tone for the sexual behavior on his ship. This is all in quotes. It depends much on the disposition and attention of the captain. When I was in the trade, I knew several commanders of African ships who were prudent, respectable men, that's almost laughable, and who maintained a proper discipline and regularity in their vessel, but there were too many of a different character. In some ships, perhaps in most, the license allowed in this particular was almost unlimited. Moral turpitude was seldom considered, but they who took care to do the ship's business might, in other respects, do what they pleased. I think this is really important, and a lot of times this gets greatly minimized or ignored all the way, as you talked about in rewriting history. Just can you touch on this briefly?
Yes, I think what you've touched on there is one of the unspoken issues really behind the slave trade, and that is that this is the beginning of something that continues right through to the plantations. It varies from place to place, but what you're looking at here is a system that is grotesquely violent towards women. That the sexual exploitation of African women on board the slave ships is a major theme that runs through the whole history. Now, the problem is that contemporaries don't like writing about it. I mean, if you listen to the way that particular passage is written, I mean, he doesn't spell it out in detail. He's kind of circumventing it. He's telling you exactly what happened without spelling it out. And it's not unlike the kind of abolitionist writing about slavery on plantations in the American South. They hint at some dark deeds that go on, but don't like spelling it out in too much, because they don't want to offend contemporary readers. But there's no doubt about it that if we look at what happened on the slave ships and what happened to African women incarcerated below, they are treated in sexually by the sailors, who regard them as theirs for the taking. Newton talks about it quite openly. Other slave captains write about it indirectly. And Newton himself was a pretty brutal man. I mean, all right, he writes Amazing Grace, and we all remember him for that. But he has a track record as a slave trade captain that included violence on his own part. But the most extraordinary acts of violence were not just the killings and the brutalization of all the Africans who go through this process, but the singling out of women for sexual pleasure on the part of the crew and the officers.
Sexual terror and rape, just endemic all throughout in this process, all the way up Daniel Holtzclaw, I would add. That sort of thing, people saying, you know, this is you have some quote-unquote respectable slave ship captains. I hear that sort of thing said all the time, and I just laugh. That's the sort of thing where I say, at least for me, I closely interrogate the type of words that are used when white authors specifically are writing about this process. If I'm reading authors who are writing about it contemporary to the time of this form of slavery or even current day, can you just talk about how widespread that sort of thing is?
Talking about them as respectable, you mean?
Respectable slave ship captains or other ways.
It's a strange phenomenon, isn't it? Because if you take the case of John Newton, right? We all know him, as I said, for writing Amazing Grace. Now, this is a man who is a devout Christian. And that seems really, really weird. Inexplicable, really. How can a good Christian be a slave captain? But a couple of nights at Sandy Point at St. Kitts in, I think, 1757, where Newton docks next to another slave ship, and there's a man next door, the captain, is a captain out of London, and he is an amateur theologian, and the two men spend three or four nights talking about theology. They talk about how you get grace, how do you attain grace, how can you get to heaven. And these two men are talking about biblical Christian issues while sitting on their slave decks that they've just sailed across the Atlantic full of Africans, and whilst their crew are fumigating the slave decks to get the stink of the holds clear. And they see nothing inconsistent in having a discussion about Christianity and giving praise to the Lord for getting them across the Atlantic safely and what they've just done. And it's one of these extraordinarily difficult things to get into our minds, really, about what shaped a person like that? What shaped an 18th century sailor who could be a Christian and go to church regularly and believe in all the things the good Christian believes in, and yet not see anything immoral, wrong, outrageous in what he was doing. I mean, it's one of the extraordinary kind of conflicts that you have in looking at this. I mean, it's one of the tremendous difficulties teaching this subject, because younger people find it very, very hard to come to terms with, that a man could be a Christian and do these terrible deeds.
Context of white supremacy. This is a passage, this is in chapter 3 still. For me, it's on 107. Where you write that men obliged to clear up such filth took out their resentment on the Africans. These are crew members on the slave ships who might have to clean it up, mm-hmm. the vomit and all that. You write, one slave ship surgeon told how they grew angry with the slaves and used to beat them inhumanly with their hands or with a cat whip. The ships brutalized everyone on board. And just that last sentence, the ships brutalizing everyone on board, that was another one where I had pause for someone writing and saying that the terrorists, that's how I view, you know, anyone who's involved in the slave ship aspect, this is an act of terrorism, to say mm-hmm. that everyone involved was brutalized. Even the people who signed up voluntarily, who are getting paid nicely to do this, that they too have been brutalized. Can you kind of explain what you mean, that everyone on the slave ships was brutalized?
Yeah, I think that it's pretty obvious what happens to the slaves being brutalized. I think that the process actually expects the men in there in charge of them to engage in kind of brutal behavior that they wouldn't behave in normally. I mean, these are men who are frightened of their lives. They're terrified. They take it out. They take their fear out of the African victims. They behave in a brutal fashion, and the whole system is a institutional brutalization of both sides. And clearly no one's saying that what happens to the Africans is the same as what happens to the crew, but the men who do this are stripped of their kind of humanity in the process. They behave in ways which are less than human.
That, it for me, it sticks out a lot, because I hear white people speak in the same terms about acts of white supremacy that are practiced today, where they will say that mm-hmm. everybody is a victim of racism, the same, almost identical to what you just laid out, that white people are stripped of their mm-hmm. humanity when they practice racism. And for me, it's totally unacceptable, because I don't hear any other crime where everyone becomes a victim of the crime. Any other time that I hear someone talk about a crime, you have victims and you have perpetrators. It does not become something where everybody involved in the crime has been brutalized or has lost their humanity. I just don't hear that consistently with any other crimes that are committed by people. I hear it mm-hmm. consistently when we're talking about white people practicing racism. And I think it's right. Just in my view, I find it totally incorrect. I think that there is a much better way that that can be constructed, as opposed to just the ships brutalized everyone. Everyone lost their humanity in this process.
And what you have to remember in all this, of course, is that, like anybody who writes a book, I mean, you're writing a book as a kind of ongoing, continuing argument and debate. The fact that we're actually having this discussion wouldn't have happened, couldn't have taken place, had this book not existed. I'd not put these arguments out in front of you. And, you know, but what we then think about, talk about, write about later is changes in relation to the discussion and the kind of discussions that we have about what's been written. This is not set in stone. This is part of an argument that's continuing.
Right on. Mr. Wavlin, if you can kind of lay out, because this is kind of the way it goes in the book, you don't just hop into what happened on the Zong. You give background in the city of Liverpool. This is what was happening with the slave trade in general. And then you get to, okay, this is what took place with the Zong. Can you kind of lay out this story, this Dutch slave ship that gets captured? Mm-hmm. It's already got, I think, approximately 200 Africans on it at the time that it's taken. The Gregson syndicate takes over. And can you just kind of mm-hmm. set out what happens? And even allegedly, because we don't really know exactly what happened, but just, you know, kind of what's theorized to have taken right. place.
Well, this is a ship that was a Dutch slave ship, which had been seized by the Brits, by the Royal Navy, and was then sold on the African coast to a British slave captain who had money to buy another one. It already had Africans on board ready to be taken across the Atlantic. It changed its name from the Zorg to the Zong when it became a ship from, they registered in Liverpool then. And they waited offshore until they filled it up again. And this was the pattern, of course, that slave ships very often spent longer on the coast of Africa filling up until the captain thought he had the right number of Africans before they headed off into the trade winds and across the Atlantic. So those Africans already on board the Zong, being that we don't know how long they'd been on board, but they have to then wait months before other Africans join them until the captain, a man called Collingwood, thinks that he has enough to sail to Jamaica, to Black River in the southwest tip of Jamaica. And they set off. The captain is very sick. The water runs out, runs short, so they say. They make navigational errors as they're going through the Caribbean. It looks as if they're going to run out of water. The crew have a discussion led by Collingwood, who is very sick, and they decide someone knows something about maritime insurance. And those old slave ships are covered on insurance for their cargoes, and the cargoes are African people. You can claim the loss of that cargo if, you, let's say, a ship founders and goes down in a storm. You can claim that. So you can claim for them the price that you paid for them in Africa. You could claim that in a British court from the insurers. But in this case, they decide to kill them so that they will actually arrive with some healthy ones rather than everyone dying from thirst. So they kill some, 130-odd, throw them overboard in three separate batches, and then get to Black River where the survivors are sold. The irony of this story, I mean, there are many ironies in this, but the bizarre twist to this is that we would not have known anything about it had it not been for the fact that the insurers in Britain refused to pay. They said, we're not paying for deliberate killing of Africans. The shippers take it to court saying, we want our insurance cover. And they take it to court without any sense that what's happened is a kind of moral outrage or a mass murder, a massacre. All they're interested in is this as an insurance claim. That's the only thing that they're challenging. And the court hears this case at a number of different stages, although the evidence is a bit peculiar in places. The only thing that court is taken into account is, can they legitimately claim the loss of those Africans as an insurance item, not as murder, not as a massacre? And the Lord Chief Justice, ultimately, Lord Mansfield, has to sit in judgment and make a decision. Is the death of those Africans covered by the insurance policy on the slave ship? And of course, once that comes into court, there are people in London who see this, including Africans living in London, saying, this is a scandal of quite extraordinary proportions. This is not an insurance case. This should be a murder case. And there's one man in particular, Granville Sharp, who leads the charge about this. But he's tipped off about the whole case by Olo Daiquiano, the African living in London, who clearly picked it up from other Africans around him. This is a murder case. But when it's heard in court, it's not heard as a murder case. It's heard as an insurance claim. It's heard as a dispute between the insurers, who won't pay up, and the insured, the ship owners called the Gregsons in Liverpool, who want the money for the 130-odd Africans that their crew had murdered. And that's the story.
Fascinating. You have be searching for the correct term to categorize this. It's a chilling passage. I want to read this, even though this is much, much later in the book. For me, this is 278. It's in Chapter 8, A Matter of Necessity, which is an important title for the chapter. But you write, one of the Africans spoke some English and told Kelsall, this would be the first mate on the ship, the Zong, that the people shackled below decks were murmuring on account of the fate of those who had been drowned. Rumor had spread among the shackled Africans that they were being killed because the ship's supplies were running short. They begged they might be suffered to live, and they would not ask for either meat or water, but could live without either till they arrived at the determined port. This unknown African was pleading for every surviving African on the Zong, all of whom knew that they were under a death sentence. All asked to be spared despite the inevitability, grim privations that would follow. They had seen shipmates marched on deck at dusk, had watched as their ranks below decks thinned out, and had heard the shrieks of the drowning. Anything, hunger and thirst, seemed preferable to the horrifying fate awaiting them in the dark waters west of Jamaica. Any comments you want to get in, Mr. Wildman?
Yes, I mean, that is an extraordinary piece of evidence, actually, that I found almost by accident by following up another lead and finding this paper that was signed by Kelso, the first mate. And what he's reporting there is one African voice from the belly of the slave ship. We have very, very few Africans speaking in their own voice like that in the evidence. We have the data, we have the numbers, we have the figures, men, women, ages, numbers, African backgrounds. What we don't have are Africans speaking openly. And here is an African speaking on behalf of all the others below deck saying, spare us, we'll do without food, but spare us. They're begging for their lives. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible story and a terrible piece of evidence. But it's ignored. It's ignored and 130 odd are drowned. The question then is, of course, I mean, why do they do it? I mean, why do they kill them? Remember that the whole point of this trade is not to kill Africans, it's to get them to the Americas to sell them. It's to make money from it. It's economics lying behind this whole system. Why would you kill them if you can make money from them? Well, they thought that perhaps they would make less money if the water didn't spread, or if the water was there, was limited. Keep it to those that might survive, and the weaker ones you throw overboard. But it turns out, of course, that the ones they selected to be killed were just selected at random. They weren't the sick ones, they weren't the old, they weren't the feeble. They were just any Africans. And there are a number of real serious unanswered questions about this. Was it the work of particularly violent men? I mean, particularly homicidal group. They have an interest in keeping Africans alive. They get a bonus at the end of the voyage. You don't get a bonus if you kill them. So, but that evidence is such a terrible piece of, it's kind of haunting voice from the belly of a slave ship, people asking for their lives.
You've done, you know, a lot of research. You had written about this, the Zong, prior to even writing this book. You had written about it and, you know, researched it. Some of the evidence that you present in this book that certainly stands out to me. Number one, these ships normally would have a logbook that would detail everything that, you know, took place during the course of the voyage. On this ship, the logbook disappears, so you don't have a record of what happened. They change the name of the ship after it does make it to Jamaica. It changes from the Zong to the Richard, which is strange, seeming like you want to get some distance from what the title that this ship originally had. And eventually it comes out once this case goes to court, and there's even going to be a retrial, it looks like, but that never happens. It comes out that it rained at some point after wait a minute, we might have a water problem. It rains. And so wait a minute, if it rains, then you should be able to catch rainwater. Why or how is it that you would have water? In addition to this firsthand testimony, apparently, of one of the enslaved Africans saying that, hey, we could go without water and food. Just don't throw us overboard. We want to live. What do you have a theory as to why this happened? Why did they kill? And we don't even really, I mean, it's approximate 130 Africans.
I don't. I mean, this is an odd thing. I think I said a second ago, you know, there are real unanswered questions about this. I've looked at all the stuff in more detail than almost anyone, really, and I'm still perplexed about why it took place. I think there are problems about the command of the ship. I think there are problems about who's in charge, who's actually issuing the orders. And I think the other main problem is the evidence that once it's all over and once these men are back in England, I think they realize the enormity of what they've done. I think that some of them realize that if this story comes out, they're likely to be in serious trouble, even though similar incidents happen elsewhere in the Atlantic. I think they realize that something's gone badly wrong here from their point of view. And they may pay for this. And indeed, that's one of the things that Granville Sharp wanted to do. He wanted the Admiralty. He wrote letters to the Admiralty saying, you must charge these men with murder. Because the Admiralty covers the legality of what happens on British mercantile ships. He said, you must find these men and prosecute them for murder. And I think it dawned on some of them that that might actually come their way. It didn't, and so there's the logbook disappears. I mean, this whole thing smells badly, quite apart from the grotesque, murderous illegality of it. It smells badly. Things don't add up. The name is changed after they leave Jamaica. The Zong logbook disappears. We don't know, did the captain give the orders or not? There's this mysterious man on board who seems to know more about maritime insurance than he should do. And I've been able to track him back to his work in West Africa, and he was a rogue and a liar, and yet he was the man whose evidence was listened to in court. The evidence around this is a kind of fog inside an enigma. But at the heart of it, no one's denying the central reality of this story, and that is that 130-odd Africans die, are murdered. It's a massacre. And in a spectacular fashion, even by the standards of the slave trade, even by the grotesque, bloody standards of the Atlantic slave trade, this sticks out as an extraordinary story.
Mm. Context of white supremacy. Just as I read all of this, I'm trying to think, and particularly given all the evidence that you put forward in the book, that this is not an uncommon thing to kill a significant portion of Africans on a slave ship, throw them overboard, whatever, scald them, whatever you have to do. Mutilating, you have some passages where you describe in detail where sometimes that's used as an act of terrorism to mutilate the bodies, to terrorize and intimidate the Africans so that they won't revolt, so that they will respect white authority. I'm having a hard time conceptualizing what person would have thought, whether it's Robert Stubbs or anybody in the Gregson Syndicate, who would have thought that other white people are going to indict us for this. When this sort of thing happens on a regular basis, how are we going to get in trouble? And just emphasize, this didn't go to trial for murder. This went to trial for insurance. We're trying to get our money for killing these Africans, not, anybody's on trial for murder or crime, anything, manslaughter, nothing. This is just, we're trying to get our money, which they win the case. And I even thought in that there shouldn't really be any surprise there. These are just animals, horses, cargo, really. That's the way that we think of Africans, who realistically would have thought we're going to get in some trouble. And by whom? Without indicting a whole lot, maybe the whole city of Liverpool.
Well, you've touched on something that lurks in the background of all this, and that is things are changing. Things are changing in Britain. There are people around who are saying, listen, this is not just an outrage in itself, but it's an outrageous indication of the broader outrage of the slave trade. Granville Sharp and others, the Quakers in particular, the small group of Africans in London, they've been jumping up and down for some time complaining about this, saying, listen, these terrible deeds that have been done to us and to many others, it's not just individual stories. It's not just an outrage to me, to my brothers. It's an outrage in general. And it's okay, the British and others saying, this is a very important economic business. You make a lot of money from it. How do you square that with being a Christian nation? There are new voices around, particularly nonconformists, particularly early Methodists, particularly Quakers, who are saying, doesn't this fit uneasily with us as Christian people? And I think that's the thing that's changing in the last 30 years of the 18th century. There's a kind of, hard to put your finger on it, there's a change of religious mood that actually affects a lot of people. And I think it's very hard these days to talk to people and say, well, religious feeling is something that matters. But in the 18th century it did. And a number of people saying this aspect of British and other people's behavior doesn't fit easily with us as a Christian people. Now, I'm not saying that people turn against slavery because they're Christian, because, as I've just said a little earlier, John Newton was a good Christian, but was a slave trade captain. But there are more and more people who have doubts about how you square one with the other. And that kind of argument runs right through American slavery, right up to the Civil War. How do you square slavery with Christianity?
Fascinating. You include some of the details from the trial, I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't include the section where you write about Lord Mansfield and his judgment, the trial, mm-hmm. first time around. This is 1783, really the only time around, even though they do conclude eventually that there, yep. should be a retrial. It never happens, so there is only the one trial. But you write, though Lord Mansfield said very little, some of his interventions have survived to become his best remembered words. Indeed, they have served to haunt and to sully his reputation. Mansfield pointed out that in the trial in March 1783, the matter left to the jury was whether it was from necessity, for they had no doubt, though it shocks one very much, the case of slaves was the same as if horses had been thrown overboard. It is a very... mm-hmm. shocking case. I thought that was that right there, in my view, that right there goes to the crux of the thinking, I think, that, yeah. dominated the times.
Well, that quote is, it captures it, really. It captures the whole thing. It is the same as if horses had been thrown overboard. And what he said, I mean, Mansfield, remember, was the great master of maritime law. He'd reorganized and rationalized English maritime law. He knew it. This is why it came to him. He's the man, of course, who also sat in the Somerset case a few years before, 1772, deciding, could a person be shipped out of England as a slave? Could a slave be returned to North America as a slave? Or did English law cover him to be a free man? This is the same Lord Mansfield. He's also the same Lord Mansfield. I don't know if you remember 2 years ago the movie Bell, about the young black woman who lived in the Lord Chief Justice's house. Mm-hmm. Well, that is Lord Justice Mansfield. His niece was Belle, the woman who was the star of that movie. And, the movie was the fictional take, really, of this basic story. So here is this man who is the Lord Chief Justice making his decision about the Zong, making the decision about the slave Somerset, could he be a slave in England, who also had a niece who was a black woman living in his house with him at his beautiful home on Hampstead Heath in London. This is a very very complicated story. What does he think about the Zong when he looks into this woman's eyes, as he dines with her, has breakfast with her? Does he think that the people that were he's talking about had any kind of resemblance to this woman, that this woman, Belle, her mother was an African slave in Jamaica? He must have thought there are links here. There must have thought there's some kind of connection. But, of course, that quote, him saying it's the same as if horses have been thrown overboard, is the one quote that people remember from the zillions of words that he wrote in legal judgment, a very long legal career. If anyone remembers one quote from Lord Chief Justice Mansfield, it's him. It's that one. It's as if horses have been thrown overboard. But, of course, what he was saying is they're cargo. They're like planks, they're like horses, but of course, you cannot read that without feeling the kind of offense of the words themselves.
Mm. You, right, this is just the page over for me. You continue, the comparison with jettisoned horses enraged critics then and since. Despite his disavowals and qualifications, Mansfield appeared to adopt the language of the slave traders themselves. To many observers, the Lord Chief Justice appeared trapped by the very commercial system with its intimate links to slavery, which his own legal career had helped to shape and refine. When you say he was trapped, what do you mean specifically?
Well, he's trapped by the nature of the case. He's being asked, is it a matter of insurance law? Are the slaves on board this ship, are they items of trade? Are they property? That's what he's trapped by. You know, he made it absolutely clear, I'm not talking about this as a murder case. That's not what the legal issue is here. The legal issue is insurance, property. And that is the whole basis of the slave trade. The whole slave trade was the nature of property. People buying other people as things, as chattel, as items of trade, and buying them and selling them and exchanging them. So, the slave trade creates this bizarre world where people have to take it on its own terms. This is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with people as things, which is why when the abolitionists get moving, only a couple of years after this, they have to make this assertion, am I not a man and a brother? That's the whole point of that phrase. Am I not a man and a brother? They're trying to say, I'm not a piece of property. I'm not a chattel. I'm not a thing. Unlike you and me, We're all the same.
Context of white supremacy. After the trial, you talk about the rise of the abolitionist movement in Britain, that, you know, we shouldn't be doing this, getting rid of the African slave trade, and you give a lot more detail on Granville Sharp and Dr. Mm-hmm. Peter Peckard, a lot of the white people that got seriously involved in this and producing material to make this a more popular movement. So this is not just something that academics are sitting in around talking about and getting into the details, so that just regular people, everyday folks, understand what's happening and are feeling outraged about this, that we should stop. And I view this as one phase of racism, white supremacy, because certainly, okay, even if we stop the African Atlantic slave trade, that certainly does not stop white supremacy in the form of colonialism. It certainly does not stop what happened on the continent of Africa after this for generations, Cecil Rhodes and all of that that was to come, happened in India. So I try to reconcile all of that as I'm moving forward. What is your processing of that?
Well, you put your finger on the whole thing. The idea that somehow or other this all ends with the ending of the slave trade or the ending of slavery is not true, because what you're looking at is a kind of the way the attitudes towards black people have become deeply embedded in white society and survived long after slavery itself is over. And it takes different forms, but it becomes a pronounced issue again, as you said, I mean, in European colonialism in Africa. I mean, I've talked about this in Africa itself. You can't get away with pretending to African students at African universities that this is a story that ends with the ending of slavery, because, you know, these are people who grew up under colonial systems. They know what colonialism was like. They know how their grandparents and parents were treated by colonial regimes. They know that this is a system that survived and lived on long after slavery itself was over. So I'd be the last one to say that when this whole thing is brought to an end, formally end, by the freeing of Africans in the Americas at different dates, you know, but, and again, remember that slavery itself continues until 1888 in Brazil. I knew a lady whose father owned slaves in Brazil. I mean, that's how close it is. No one who knows anything about world history would argue that this brings an end to racism. And at this point, I'm running out of time at this side, by the way.
Okay. I'll try and see if we can, if any folks have a quick question that they want to get in. I did want to definitely ask, do you have a viewpoint on reparations for all of this? Because that's something that's been talked about a lot.
Yeah, it's a big debate. I was listening to a man called Hilary Beckles talk about it the other night. Jamaican, prominent leader of the Jamaican campaign for reparations. Well, I think what reparations must be, it must be clearing up the colonial mess that the British, but not just the British, I mean the French, the Portuguese, the Spaniards, all the great European colonial powers left in their wake a colonial mess of quite enormous proportions of poverty, of uneducated, of lack of education, of poor facilities, you name it, and a continuing exploitation of Africa in particular. But not just Africa, that, again, seems so obvious that it's scarcely worth pointing it out. I think that reparations should be the first thing that the West has got to become clear about, is their role in creating this. That is education. That is the way we think about our past, the way we talk about it, the way we write about it, the kind of debates we have, well, the discussion you and I have just had for the last hour. All of this is the West coming clean about what it did to non-white people around the world, and making sure that that is part of the way we think about history. That's the first step. Now, reparations in terms of money, I don't think that's going to happen. I can't see any major Western power coughing up the zillions of pounds and dollars that would be needed to cover this. And I think it's, in a way, I think it's misleading people if you lead people to believe that that's going to happen. But I don't think that's what reparations are necessarily about. I mean, the idea that it's people holding their hand out for money is not what you're talking about. You're talking about actually setting in place a new view of the past, really, and trying to do something about the damages that have been caused.
I know you said you're running out of time, so I want to see if we can get some of the callers in really quickly for a quick question. Thomas in New York, did you have a quick question for Mr. Wildman? You should be with us.
In the past, radio campaign does have a few events here in Reno.
Your television is very loud in the background. If you could, you know, mute that or what have you, or move away if you had a quick question that you wanted to get in. Thomas in New York, did you have a question? Television is still very loud. I'll get our other caller. The caller who dialed in on the vote line, did you have a question for Mr. Wildman?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for taking my call. Good afternoon, everyone. I was wondering, it looks like you've been studying this for a long, long time. What got you interested in this area of research? Thank you.
Well, thank you. I got interested in it because it's no one had really been talking about it, but also, this is actually a story about Britain. People say, well, what's a white man writing about black history for? Well, it's actually about white men as well. This is a story that's not just about Africa and the Americas. It's a story about Britain and what made Britain great. There's the irony. I thought that the kind of British history that I'd learned as an undergraduate, even as a graduate student, didn't tell me the full story. And what I've been trying to do throughout my career, really, is kind of rectify that in a way. So that makes sense.
Yes, it does. Thank you. I have one more question. Do you have any close relationships with African people besides professional, like personal, intimate, anything like that, marriage?
My wife was born in India, if that makes any difference. And I've got loads of mates, friends, colleagues, Afro-Caribbean, British Caribbean, and that's the world I move in.
You say your wife was born in India, was she like a missionary? Is she like actually Indian or?
Yeah, Anglo-Indian, yeah.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You said she's Anglo-Indian, so is she a white woman that just was born in India?
No. Her parents were, one side of the family is Indian, the other side's English.
Oh, okay. Got it. Right. Thank you for the question. Is she able to be accepted as a white person? Like when people see her, do they think she's a white person?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah. The person that called in from a block number, did you have a quick question for Mr. Wildman? Wildman?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I can hear it, yeah.
Thank you for your work. If you have received any negative feedback from other people who classify themselves as white.
Gus, can you repeat that for me? I missed a bit of it.
He said, have you received any negative feedback from any white people for the work that you've done?
It's like anything else, really. You get criticism, don't you? No one should expect not to be criticized. And the Zong has been, it's been well received, I think, on the whole, but people criticize it. Not necessarily, I don't think necessarily white people criticize it. I mean, a lot of people have criticized my work for being a bit too brutal towards white history, British history in general. On the other hand, you know, the kind of criticisms that were made this evening in the discussion, I mean, you get that frequently. But that's, as I said a little earlier, this is part and parcel of being in this business. You know, I'm not coming down Mount Sinai with a tablet under my arm. I'm making an argument here. I'm making an argument for people to engage in, for people to rethink their own preconceptions and perhaps tell me what mine are. Tell me where I'm right, tell me where I'm wrong. So I get criticism from left, right, and center, yeah, and that's, I think, as it should be.
I have to say, don't feel like I got my answer.
I didn't. Can you repeat that, please, sir?
I'm not sure that I got a specific answer to my specific question.
Oh, okay. He said he's not sure that he got a specific answer to his specific question.
Well, I think that's about as close to it as I can go, really. I think, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I guess our last caller, I'm going to try again. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Mr. Wildman? Trying one more time, if you have a question, sir. 9451, did you have a question or are you just listening? Okay, I will assume that they are just listening. Before I let you go, Mr. Wildman, did you have books, one or two books that you would recommend that give more evidence about rebellions, revolts that happened on slave ships that you think are really good?
Yes, there's a book by a man called Taylor, and I'm in my study and I'm looking for it on the shelves, and it's called If We Must Die, If We Must Die, and it's by Taylor. I can't remember the first name, but that's... and of course, the other good book about the slave ships and all is Marcus Rediker, The Slave Ship. Marcus Rediker, R-E-D-I-K-E-R, Rediker, The Slave Ship. That's an extremely good book. But Taylor, If We Must Die, I think it's called. But again, this is off the top of my head.
If We Must Die. I'll find it. If We Must Die. I have your email, so I can write you if I get really confused.
Yeah, do that. And thank you very much for asking me.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Very much appreciated the dialogue, and I learned a lot. I would definitely encourage listeners to check out the book, The Zong, by James Wildman. A lot of great information. Like I said, I had never even heard about this report. Thank you for sharing a bit of your, I guess for you, your Monday evening. Pleasure to have you on the program, sir.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. Thanks
for sure. Good evening.
Bye. Bye.
Context of white supremacy. Fascinating. I'm going to see if I can get that title right now, who the author is. If We Must Die. Oh, got it. Okay. So the full title is If We Must Die, Shipboard Insurrections in the Era of the Atlantic Slave Trade by Eric Robert Taylor. And it Wow, the image, the cover image for the book is similar. If people remember when Dr. Frances Cress Welsing was on the program in 2013, and she talked about the huge portrait, it's like wall size, like Mr. Wildman, when he talked about the image that's on the cover of his book, that it's kind of small. If you see the actual portrait, it's at the museum in Boston. Dr. Welsing, where she said the image that she saw, this is of a African revolt on a slave ship where it's massive. It's like it takes up the whole wall. And she just said it has a stunning impact on you if you see this, particularly when you hear every day that black people are lame, black people are cowards, black people are chumps, and they don't fight back. And, you know, we deserve this from white people and black people. But it's very similar image. If you want to check it out again, the full title, If We Must Die, Shipboard Insurrections in the Era of the Atlantic Slave Trade, and it's written by Eric Robert Taylor. I'm going to see if I can get the date when this book came out to see if... Okay, so this came out, it looks like, in 2009, so this is a relatively new text. I don't know if this is a white author or a non-white author. I'll check on that as well, but I'm going to add that to my reading list. Dr. Welsing, again, reading is more important than watching television. Can't say that enough. I'll check in with any of the folks that are listening in. If you all have any feedback from Mr. Wildman, what he shared on the program, and if you got any constructive information, there was one additional title that I wanted to, or not title, passage that I wanted to share from the text, just to emphasize, again, I think so frequently, we understate, we minimize, we use a lot of euphemisms, particularly whites. We pick this up from racists when talking about slavery and the terrorism that our family, our ancestors faced, and that we continue to face, where we just are not talking about this accurately and the trauma that has been passed down to us. Let's see if I can nab this really quickly here. And this is them talking about, as he said, they ended the Atlantic slave trade, 1807, in Britain. people continue to do this, obviously. This goes on and on and on for a long time. You have that phase of slavery, white supremacy, that continued in that form for another roughly 50 years after this ended in Britain in 1807, the Atlantic slave trade. It was still happening in their colonies. We're just not actively stealing people, at least legally we're not doing this, although it continued rampantly for decades and decades and decades afterwards. But they still had that form of slavery in the colonies. Obviously, it was still running in that form in the United States at that time as well. But he's talking about some of these ships that are continuing to do this after this has allegedly been outlawed, and how one of the practices, again, very common, was if you have a slave ship and they're looking like they're going to get caught, they're being pursued, and wait a minute, you've stolen some more niggers, we're going to catch you and we're going to, you know, impound your ship. If it looks like they're in danger of being overtaken, what they would do is toss the black people overboard. And so then if they got stopped, hey, we don't have any niggers on board, so, you know, you can't do anything to us, you got to let us go. So the passage he writes, the case of the Jeune Estelle, this is a French slave ship, intercepted by HMS Tartar the same year, 1819, was equally horrifying. The vessel was from Martinique, and its master, Captain Sanguins, at first denied any involvement in slave trading. But the boarding party of British sailors remained suspicious, not least because the ship smelled like a slaver. Their attention was drawn to some barrels. A sailor who struck a cask, which was lightly closed, heard a faint voice issued from it, as of a creature expiring. The cask contained two young girls aged 12 to 14. The chilling truth dawned on the British. The casks jettisoned by the crew, which they had seen floating past them as they had chased the Jeune Estelle, had contained African slaves. As I said, this should not be minimized. We should not be using euphemisms. We should be accurate, direct, describing this as terrorism on a mass scale, organized, efficient terrorism, and seeing how this continues right on up today. Anytime we do a program, we have white people on from the UK or anybody from the UK, I always try to make sure I get in Stephen Lawrence, Doreen Lawrence. His mother was on the program twice, because this is still in effect. Stephen Lawrence, a black teenager who was stabbed to death by a gang of white goons, white terrorists in 1993, and nobody was prosecuted for his murder for almost 20 years. And even then, they only prosecuted two white terrorists. The gang had the report, sorry, it was five people. I mean, this happened out in the middle of the street in London. It was about 10 p.m. in the evening when this took place in 1993. But they only prosecuted two people. They're in greater confinement now. The other people who participated in this murder never prosecuted. They're roaming free now, and they continue to have reports that come out on a pretty regular basis. It's been almost 25 years now about police involvement. They released the McPherson report that came out in the late 90s about institutional racism within the police department, the Metropolitan Police Department in London, where they aided the murderers to avoid being prosecuted for this crime, and just did a really poor job investigating, just a horrendous case all the way around. As I said, Doreen Lawrence, we had her, Baroness Doreen Lawrence, we had his mother on the program twice. She was on in 2012 after the convictions came down for two of the racist race soldiers that participated in this murder. I would definitely encourage folks to check out that case. Again, we should be thinking about this in a global context. Racism is not anything that's just isolated to the U.S. or just one spot. With that, I will check in with any of the folks who dialed in. I think our caller, Silent Warrior, I'm going to see if I can just add you to my Skype line, because you're not as clear on the switchboard. So I'm going to just add you to my Skype line to see if that clears your line up, because you sounded a lot better yesterday. I think I will do that right now. Just give me 2 seconds, and then any of the folks that dialed in, if you all have any commentary based on what you heard on the program, we can make time for that as well. Let's see if I can add one of our international callers here. We should be back later in the week. We should have another white person. I would think anybody should be noticeable. We've had a lot more white people on the program for 2016. That is something that I do try to make an effort to do, to have white people on the program. I think it's very important to keep them front and center in talking, thinking about racism, white supremacy. White people are not ignorant. That's one other thing that I can make sure that I get in. There are a few passages, even in this book, where, and there, this incident, the main incident that we talked about, was happening in the 18th century. Even then, you have white people saying that, oh, we were just ignorant. We just didn't know about this. Even then, saying that they are ignorant about racism, it seems to be a standard defense. I don't know if it was as widespread at that time, because even I think you heard Mr. Wildman say that, you know, this was not anything that was secret or hidden, what the terrorist activities that were conducted on these slave ships. But I did even catch that in the text. But with that, if any of the folks who dialed in, our female caller who chimed in, I think Mr. Fox should be with us as well. I'll double check on Thomas in New York to see if he had any commentary also. Did you all have any commentary that you wanted to get in, and anything stood out from the broadcast?
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. One thing I guess that stood out for me, he kind of, like, he would say things like, I think this is a blatant act of racism, blah, blah, blah. He'd be like, well, whatever. Whatever you say, I already wrote the book. I got my check. So he kind of was a little dismissive. I guess the second point, the book that he recommended, If We Must Die, I tried to look it up as well. And I noticed there's a poem by Cora McKay by the same title. And then there's a book, another book, talking about the Tulsa race riots. So I don't know if this person is black, or I wonder if they got the title for that book from those books, from those writings. And then I guess on another note, since it was in Liverpool, I just think of how Michael Jackson bought the Beatles recordings, and like maybe he knew about this before we did, and that's why he bought those albums. Thank you.
That is interesting. That is interesting. Michael Jackson doesn't exactly strike me as being an ignorant fellow. My suspicion is that he probably had some notion of this. I don't know how much detail, but he just doesn't strike me as someone who was stupid. You know, he seems like someone who would have done some research, would have tried to get some information about things that were happening if he went there and visited and what have you. I suspect he might have had some details about all this. And to your first point, I think that's pretty common. Like when I think the first point when I raised that, when he said that it was mutually beneficial for the Africans and the whites who were engaged in this activity. I felt like at first he was just doing the obfuscate, because he wasn't even talking directly about my question. The point that I raised, he was really just talking about how it wasn't whites that were going in and doing the actual stealing of the Africans, and black people had to do this. The Africans were doing this. And if, you know, they didn't like the terms of the trade, that they would just not deal with the whites and all of that, which really is not getting to my question. Like, he has explicit detail in his book about how the entire city of Liverpool prospered. Like, they came up, as we would say now, not just one individual, not just, you know, the syndicate or two that was doing this, the whole city became booming, and they built all kinds of structures and buildings and civic accomplishments as a result of all this cash that they generated from peddling in black flesh, terrorizing black people. And when I said, well, can you point to examples where whole cities in Africa came up as a result of this? And he said, well, there's no detail on that. Exactly to your point, which you said about him, in my view, just being honest and saying that that's totally false. And it stood out more to me because he said it twice in the same paragraph. He didn't just say that it was mutually beneficial and leave it at that. He said it twice in the same paragraph. So, I mean, within two sentences, it was mutually beneficial, da-da-da-da-da, it was mutually beneficial, just to try to emphasize the deception, in my view, and I will stick by what I said, in my view, that is a deliberate, conscious act of racism. And I see that all the time from whites. I think the second point where that happened was when he said that this brutalized all involved. And that's the exact same thing that I hear from modern day Timothy Wise and Jane Elliott's, that white people lose their humanity and we're all victims, even though Tim Wise did say explicitly on this broadcast that white people are not victims of racism. But I hear that all the time. White people are victims of racism, too. We're harmed by this, too. And I just assert I don't hear that with anything else. If they're talking about a white woman being raped, they don't say that the rapist and the white woman, that they were all brutalized. And nobody says that. When they're talking about 9/11, nobody says that the alleged terrorists and the victims were all brutalized by this attack. Nobody says that. They only do this sort of thing when they're talking about terrorism directed at black people.
I agree. That must be the greatly pained that Mr. Coates was talking about. I guess.
I reckon. Anything else stood out from the folks that are with us? I think our caller in Norway should be back on my line, it looks like. Mr. Fox, I guess I'll double check with Thomas in New York, even though I didn't hear anything. I checked several times if y'all had any comments to get in.
That's the person in the United States with a job. And that's why he'll have to wipe a net.
I'm just hearing the, or I guess it could be something else. I'm just hearing what sounds like TV or something playing in the background. So I assume Thomas in New York might just be listening to the broadcast. You know, if you had something to chime in, I might check before we sign out. Anything else stand out from the folks who are on the line, or is everybody satisfied?
I'd like to say something.
Yes, sir.
Our guest was on Team White. I noticed I will be listening to the entire broadcast. I only got a little bit near the end. However, I'm just observing now where we asked him, does he have intimate relationships with anyone who is non-white or something like that, and then he said his wife is Indian, Anglo-Indian. And then you have to ask two or three or four questions before you found out that she's someone who passes for white and most likely actively passes for white. And then so that was kind of like hiding of information. And then when I asked him for if he's been given negative feedback from other white people, because for me that's a kind of a litmus test, if other white people are telling this white person stop, then that can be interesting. But he held the fort and he would not tell us if he was attacked or, you know, given negative feedback. He generalized it, which I thought was a bit unfortunate. It would have been very useful information for us. Then finally, when he's talking about repatriations, you know, when people who talk about slavery frame it in purely economic terms, I mean, I feel like they have the same mindset as a slave master, who's thinking about money. Or, you know, who claims that he's only thinking about money. Because it would be, you would really, I mean, if it was all about money, then you would treat your quote-unquote slaves better so that they would live longer. Did you know in Haiti, the French had it down to a science that the Africans would be dead within 4 years of being in Haiti? Within 4 years, they expected a slave that was brought to Haiti to like perish, to a science, because they, you know. So when he's talking about things like can't expect for these bazillions and bazillions of dollars to be going back to, I mean, my one question, well, all European nations these people just stop practicing racism. You know, because, I mean, regardless of what his education proposal, I mean, that sounds like, isn't that what we got with colonialism? Education and neocolonialism, education, and even now, you know, the only a few people from the colonial countries are going to the former colonial masters for education. Crap. Honestly, I feel like he's got the academic, so-called academic distance from this, which is ridiculous, because if we took his wife into slavery, you'd get right quick aggressive about it, and talk about, you know, he would want his rights protected, he would want his humanity to be valued, but instead he's talking about about money. Me personally, when it comes to repatriations, I'm more interested in let's replace white supremacy with justice. Once that is done, then we can talk repatriations or anything else. But to replace white supremacy with justice, that's where the real money is at. I mute my line.
For sure. I do want to make sure I'm saying more consistently. I do ask that question because I realize that's something that people are talking about, and a lot of our callers are very eager to hear responses, particularly when we have whites on the program who present this sort of information and give the appearance they might fool a lot of victims into thinking that, oh, this is a good white person to have all this information. So, you know, they're probably on our side to try to solve this problem. But I take the stance that, you know, reparations without ending the practice of white supremacy is not going to do much of anything. Even if it was financial or some of the other manifestations that I hear when people say, well, reparations in the form of, you know, let's get some sort of housing system where all black people have housing taken care of for the next 500 years, or educational process where, you know, all black people, all non-white people even get free education. They can go to any school, any university in the world that they want to for the next 500 years for free. Everything is taken care of and they can stay as long as they want, regardless of how it was manifested. I just conclude it would not be worth much if whites are still practicing white supremacy. You would just be going to institutions of white supremacy, as the caller just alluded to, and it would have to be updated as long as they're continuing to practice white supremacy. So if they give out, you know, reparations in 2016, they would then have to turn around again in, you know, 2056 and say, oh, well, we've been doing stuff to you all for the last 50 years, so this is the updated reparations for the stuff that we've done over the last 50. And it would just be ongoing to compensate, unless you're going to actually stop practicing white supremacy and replace that with justice. I just don't know what the benefit of getting quote-unquote reparations would be if you're going to continue to terrorize black people in particular, non-white people on the whole. I even thought it was interesting that in his response, he said that he doesn't think of it so much as money. He thinks of it more as being accurate, being truthful about what whites have done to non-white people, because that is not the way that I generally hear people talk about quote-unquote reparations and just having white people be honest. And even if it's on that minimal level, I don't even see whites being willing to do that. I don't see white people being willing to even be truthful, even in his account where he's saying that, hey, this was this slave trade was mutually beneficial for whites and African. I don't even see white people being willing to do that and to just be honest about what they have planned to do to black people under the global war of racism, white supremacy.
Can I respond real quick?
Yes, sir.
When you say that he said that part of reparations would be to talk about what has been done, what white supremacy has done in the past 500 years. Does he have any contribute any analysis to what white supremacy is doing now to the descendants of these African slaves? I mean, does he have any current affairs analysis about how racism is being practiced now?
That would be good. That would have been a good question to ask him. Most of the stuff that I've seen that he where he talks about racism, it's in its earlier phases, things that happened, you know, 18th century, 19th century, way back when. But that would have been a good question to ask. I don't know if he has text things that he's written offering information on 21st century practices of white terrorism. I don't know. Doubtful. It's been my experience. Most white people don't want to give up any details on that.
One last thing. Chess. I'm thinking about chess and chess moves. And I feel like suggestion he makes, you know, any suggestion short of replacing white supremacy with justice is a sort of, it's like, okay, I'm going to give you this rook, rook right here, but I'm still going to get your king. Because, for example, I'm going to give you a black president in the United States, but we're going to have, we're going to reduce the wealth of African American families during his presidency, and he's not going to be able to do anything about it. So I give you this rook, this president, but I'm going to hit you hard on the left-hand side. I'm flanking you on both sides. Hit you over there, and then I'm going to be hitting you with TV programming like Scandal, 12 Years a Slave. And then when it's time for the president to be ending, then, you know, then we're going to have about 2 years of black men being killed with police, and nobody can do anything about it. So when he suggested, when these incomplete or probably insincere solutions are suggested by people who classify themselves as white, I'm learning to be wary of them, because I know that if they do something that white people will say, now white supremacy is going down, then those other white people will come their game up even higher against non-whites. I think probably the best strategy is to... I'm more interested... That's why I asked my question about the reaction of other white people towards him, because that's where... I think that's where the secret data is. What's going on the other side of the chessboard, sir? What's the discussion that you guys are having over there? I mute my line.
For sure, for sure.
That is information it never give up, is it?
Mr. Fox chiming in there. I agree. That's sort of deep. In fact, I would just fast forward. I think it's, at least for me, it's a pretty good litmus test about how honest this white person is going to be when I ask about the greatly pained, sincerely and greatly pained whites. When he said immediately, oh, sure, I know tons. And any white person, when that's the sort of response that they have, that already lets me know that, okay, this white person is not willing to give up very much information at all. In fact, they're actively engaged in just promoting a lot of deception in terms of how we're thinking about this, even if they're giving correct information and a lot of data about things that happened 300 years ago. For a white person to come out and say that they think what's happening right now with the 2016 presidential election in the United States illustrates sincerely and greatly pained whites, with Donald Trump blowing out the field, that, right, in my opinion, that should let you know as much as you need to about how honest this white person is willing to be, particularly talking about contemporary issues. Maybe I'm willing to slam and identify some of these whites from 200, 300 years ago who have been long since dead. But talking about things that are happening right now, 2016, you are not going to get a lot of honesty here.
Did he actually say that, or you just had that as an example?
No, that's what he said. That's what he said.
He said,
when I asked him, I said, well, how did the white, because he said, oh, yeah, sure, I know lots of whites who are sincerely and greatly pained. The white people that I'm around, absolutely. And I said, well, how did they demonstrate this? And he said, well, look at what's happening with the 2016 presidential election right now. You have tons of white people that are outraged about what's happening right now and all that. That's what he said. It'll be in the archives. That's what he said.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to listen to that. But you actually do, you know, the difference from when white people are very upset because we know when animals, especially dogs, are mistreated, we actually see white people getting stuff done to make sure that this mistreatment of this animal doesn't happen again. And we've actually seen examples of white people killing other white people through the mistreatment of animals. I've not seen white people harming other white people for white people hurting black people yet. I could be wrong, but I've not seen it.
I haven't seen that either. No need, if whites were here, I'm sure I would hear a John Brown reference. But that's, if anything, that is one thing I am so appreciative of Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., where he says, and I've heard him say it repeatedly, where in his mind, even John Brown would still be a racist suspect. He doesn't give any songs, no hymns, no praises. I don't care if he killed, got all of his sons killed and his wife. He's still on the racist suspect list as long as this system exists. But yeah, absolutely. I see whites when they are sincerely and greatly pained the way that they were after 9/11, or if we were talking UK after 7/7/05, then I saw sincerely pained where it's bang, this is never going to happen again. Let's get to work right now. Like, I have seen them when they get really serious and they're totally outraged and they are committed to stopping something. I have never seen that with racism, white supremacy, and the terrorism against black people. Never. And just to make sure that I get in, because religion came up, it is the religion of white supremacy. I thought that was fantastic, the details about John Newton, this white guy who allegedly, eventually, after he finished his time as a slave trader, eventually became an abolitionist, and oh, this is terrible, this is horrible, and I'm a good Christian white man. It is the religion of white supremacy.
Yeah, when he's finished making all of his money and his gold coins, then he goes to practicing his religion. Just regarding the white people solving problems, I think I might have sent you this clip before on Twitter. It was a clip of it was a great white shark which was washed up on the beach, and all the white people there realized, obviously, there's a problem, we have to solve it. So they made a little trench from where the shark was on the beach leading to the water, and they got that shark back, that deadly shark, mind, Jaws, back in that water. And that shark was on its way to do whatever it had to do. You could even kill one of these people in the future, but they saw a problem and they got it solved like that.
Absolutely. I do not see that sort of dedication to problem solving as it relates to black people. If anything, it's how can we cause them more problems and more difficulties. Absolutely. And same thing. I think a lot of people have noted that where whites, they tend to be, if there's any sincere or great pain, it tends to be when horses are mistreated, sharks are mistreated, squirrels are mistreated, albino, anything is mistreated. Then they are sincerely and greatly pained. Not Negroes. Never.
Yeah, it reminds me, you had that episode, was it called Niggers and Squirrels?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, when was that? Was that about, was that 2010 or 2012?
2012, sounds about 2012, 2012, maybe even 2011.
Yeah, that's a great episode. That just says it all. I've never seen a white man go to jail for lynching a nigger, but I have seen one go to jail for killing a squirrel.
Absolutely. Still in effect. 2016. Still in effect. Where you have tons of white people who got nothing, didn't even have to go to court for killing a black person. You go out and kill a squirrel or a deer out of season. Oh, man, you might have a lynch mob ready to come after you. Particularly if it's an albino, anything, albino cricket, albino squirrel, if the mosquitoes were. It was a sound clip. I so wish I had played it. They were talking about vultures. It's a small town in the U.S., and they were having a problem. They weren't just vultures. They were black vultures. And they kept emphasizing, they were like, oh my gosh, they're aggressive. They're such a nuisance. We've got to get rid of them. Oh, the black vultures, the black vultures. And this guy comes on at the end and he's like, I disagree with this whole campaign where they're talking about getting rid of the black vultures. Like, they're not, you know, they're not violent. The way that they're constructed physiologically, they don't have a really strong beak. Like, they can't do a lot of damage. They don't attack people. They're not attacking crops. Like, I don't understand, you know, why everybody is being so aggressive about this. Like, we need to go and get rid of them right now. He was like, you know, I have a farm. I'm right here. I see them. You know, I don't understand what the problem is. But everybody else, they were furious. Like, oh, we've got this infestation of black vultures and we got to get rid of them. Oh, to like today.
And I believe their purpose is to eat dead flesh, yeah? They don't attack living flesh, do they?
Correct. Yeah. At any rate, if folks had anything else they wanted to get in before we wrap up, there was one other passage I was going to make sure I got in from the actual text, Mr. Walvin. Where I just, this sort of thing, again, is too many instances where it's kindly slave masters and respectable slave ship operators. And, you know, these are nice racists. They're not, you know, brutes and savages and rapists, where he talks about some of the practices that were taken out on slave ships. And again, he emphasized in the book that this was not secret. Like, this was not anything that people were trying to hide. Who was going to get in trouble for this? Like, who cares? You just, these are niggers, they're animals. But he writes, he's talking about some of the mutilations that took place to black people. In fact, I can back up to read a little bit where he says, readers learned that bodies of rebel Africans were commonly dismembered and defiled. William Snelgrave, himself an advocate of better treatment of enslaved Africans on board the slave ships, was as fierce as the next captain when faced with captured rebels. In 1721, one of his men had been killed in a revolt on his ship, riding at anchor near Anumabu. Snelgrave asked the captains of 8 neighboring slave ships to bring all their African captives on deck to witness the consequent punishment. They all watched the leading rebel being hauled to the yard arm. As he dangled there, 10 sailors shot him dead. The body being let down upon the deck, the head was cut off and thrown overboard. This last part was done to let our Negroes see that all who offended thus should be served in the same manner. All this was not simply a matter of revenge and intimidation. Dismembered bodies were evidence of the power of the white men, and the desecrating the African bodies was also a conscious effort to violate whatever beliefs Africans might hold dear about the body and how it passed over into the afterlife, or even how the African might escape back to Africa. Many of the blacks believe that if they are put to death and not dismembered, they shall return again to their own country after they are thrown overboard. Though slave traders had only the vaguest idea of African religious beliefs, mutilating the dead Africans was an attempt to dishonor the body and its prospects of an afterlife. Such stories had been paraded before the British reading public long before the Zong case gave the issue a new and totally unexpected twist. Fascinating. Just, I think sometimes it's very important for us to get those type of grim details about the deliberate pathologies of whites to do this sort of thing. And I would submit that you can transfer this to 21st century acts. Michael Brown's body being left in the street for 4.5 hours, those sort of things, the ongoing defiling of black bodies. I think a lot of folks talked about Trayvon Martin, where the parents, they were not able to even find where the body was for a long period of time. And then the reports that organs were missing. I think the same thing with Kendrick Johnson in Georgia, organs being missing. They couldn't even find the body. James Byrd Jr., since that just came up again yesterday, James Byrd Jr., they didn't just kill him. They killed him and then they tossed his body in a black cemetery because they had segregated, quote unquote, segregated cemeteries in Jasper, Texas for a time. So they tossed his body there. And I believe that they also urinated on the body after they had just totally mauled and killed this unarmed black male, James Byrd Jr. in Texas. This is 1998. This is not something from, you know, 18th century and ancient history. 1998, James Byrd Jr. With that, anybody have anything they wanted to get in before we wrap up, or folks satisfied?
No.
I guess we'll get our female caller first, and then we'll get everybody else too.
Hi. I know. The author, he gave a book recommendation. The book he recommended, the author is white. According to these little pictures I see, he's white. He got a doctorate in history. If you want to talk to him, I guess you go to his LinkedIn page. All his information is there. If you're interested in actually, I guess, talking to this person, because he has a master's in African American studies, like I said, but his picture is very white looking. Then he went into producing, so I don't know how he got another job so quickly. Well, because he's white. and so, yeah, I mean, I guess if you read it and wanted to talk to him, all his information is on the LinkedIn page, I think, including an email address.
Oh, right on. Put that on my to-do list. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, his picture, so you know who you're looking at. He has gray hair and blue eyes. And his picture, of course, looks happy because he's white. And his title is Historian.
Right on. I will check on that. As soon as the program wraps up, I'll invest my time checking on that. I heard other folks who had commentary. Did you all want to chat, comment?
Yeah, it was just adding on to the last page of the book you read. It is across the board when it actually comes to the non-white body, which mutilations, which they like to do, especially in Vietnam. That was very popular. In Vietnam, they used to body desecration. They used to dig up the relatives of the villagers and take pieces of their body, because they knew that in the afterlife, if you take away a body or a piece of the body, that I think it was the Vietnam tradition, the Vietnamese traditions, that if a piece of the body is not with the actual person who's died, then that person won't get eternal rest. So they used to do that a lot in Vietnam.
Standard operating procedure. I was even reminded, just processing all this, the constant, this is ongoing desecration of black burial sites worldwide, where they'll tear down and put a McDonald's over a black burial site, or a dog park where they can take their canines out for a walk, or just anything. They'll put a interstate, anything, to just totally desecrate our ancestors who have transitioned. But this is ongoing. We talked about that with Kristen Green, where they did the same thing in Richmond, Virginia, where there was a burial ground for black people. And they exactly what I just said. They put a dog park there for whites to go in and take their canines, man's best friend. Mr. Fox, were you going to comment?
No, I've already just said what I had to say.
All right, on. I assume everybody is good. I'll check Mr. Thomas in New York one more time. Seems like they're just listening. Right on. We should be back later this week. We have another white person coming on the program. If folks remember Virginia Christian, talking of Virginia, black female who was given the death penalty for killing a white woman who had assaulted her. Again, all of the people who say that black people are lames and cowards and chumps, and we don't fight back and we deserve everything we get, that is astronomically incorrect. Again, you should stop talking immediately. Anybody who presents that view, you should have your speaking privileges revoked. Stop talking and go do some studying, do some research, because it is totally inaccurate. And in my view, that is just racist rhetoric that, you know, we have repeated because we've just been confused and poorly informed. But this is a black female. This happened in the early 1900s. Where, again, she was assaulted. This white woman that she was working for, she was physically assaulted. She defended herself and ended up killing this white woman. And they gave her the death penalty. Say, white author. Now, he did write a book of fiction about this case. Now, I generally am not a big fiction fan. I don't read a lot of fiction. But he wanted to shed light on this case. He wanted to make it more public so that people, do some exploring, do some research to learn more about who Virginia Christian was and this piece of Virginia history. But he should be on the program later in the week. We'll have the time and date and all that stuff posted. We played an audio clip about this a couple weeks ago, and some folks were interested. So if you want to do some research and prep for the program, you can do so. Again, I'll post it on Facebook, the Black Talk Radio group, and all that, so you'll have details when the author, White Man, will be joining us on the program. If folks have questions, gripes, if you can't find something in the archives, feel free to just drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com, and I'll see what I can do to hook you up if you have, you know, difficulties, or if you have guest suggestions, or just a question that you want to ask to get clarification about something from the cows, untiljustice@gmail.com. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested and kept the cows rolling. 7 years, anniversary yesterday, 7 years of us doing the program. I hope we have aided folks, victims of racism, get a better understanding of what white supremacy is, how it works, what it means to be white. I will state again, sobriety would be best under conditions of racism, white supremacy. Really no time do we want to be not thinking clearly, not lucid, where we cannot make quality decisions. You never know, particularly if you're going to be out and about driving behind the wheel as a passenger or pedestrian. You never know when it's going to be Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, that is the one that is pulling you over. Under those conditions, you definitely want to be clear-headed so that you can make outstanding decisions to keep yourself safe and anybody else that you might be responsible for. Buckle up as well. Buckle up. Every time that you get behind the wheel, buckle up. Let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.